Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, everybody. How you doing? How you doing this week, Josh?
Meh.
Meh?
Just meh.
Just meh. Well, meh is better than dead.
Right. You know what would make me unmeh? If I had something from adamandeve.com that I could unmeh myself.
I am sure that there is something that Adam and Eve has that you can unmeh yourself.
What would I have to do to get this amazing deal at adamandeve.com?
The first thing you're going to have to do is hold the mic a little bit closer to your mouth, because I turned your gain down.
Okay, fair enough.
So it's a little bit nicer and hold
my
it off.
My mouth is close to
hold
stuff.
It off. I know. Hold it. Yeah, just think, listeners. You're about 2 inches away from kissing Josh Hadley.
No, we want people.
And
to
while thinking about kissing Josh Hadley, you can go to adamandeve.com, pick out a product you'd like that can make you indeed unmeh. At the very end, use the promo code STATIC, STATIC, and that will give you 50% off of that one product, 3 free Spank DVDs, and a free mystery gift. In fact, they can literally be Spank DVDs if that's what you're into, because
they got a lot of stuff there.
And then you get a free mystery gift and free shipping in the U.S. and it will unmeh your day. And also,
yeah, we got one more housekeeping thing to deal with right away.
Yep, my friend Al creates systemless gaming things. So if you're a D&D player and maybe you want to get away from the dungeons and try something a little bit new every now and then you can go and check out his systems at Point of Insanity.
And it's a cool thing if you're an RPG fan, if you're just a fantasy, and I don't mean fantasy in like just swords and sorcerers, but it's a cool thing. You can get it at drivethroughrpg.com as well as a couple other places. It's really worth it, I think.
The yep.
Systemless Settings Bundle, which is kind of a mouthful.
Yes, and it works, because then you're not tied down to D20. These literally work with any game system that's out there. And Al is a really creative guy. He's come up with this stuff, and I'm proud of what he's done. And it's just look for the Systemless Settings Bundle from Point of Insanity Game Studio, and you can also just Google Point of Insanity Game Studio, and it'll pick this stuff out for you. Let us know that Al let Al know that we sent you, and there's some neat stuff in there, so it's worth checking out.
Indeed. Well, we actually do have one other housekeeping thing: the Patreon, or Patreon,
as
I say it.
Yeah, and I want to speak directly to our patrons and to those that are thinking about becoming patrons, and they looked up patreon.com/lostinthestatic. That is changing. 1201 is going through some changes. The brand is expanding. There's some
the
changes.
Website's coming,
the website's
changed.
Being redone. Because of the way Patreon worked, we're linking it, instead of to one of our personal bank accounts, we're linking it to another one. And so rather than trying to go through the rigmarole of doing that with Patreon, which they make it seem very easy on their page, and then you try and do it and it's not
arduous.
What we're doing is, do us a favor, go to patreon.com/radiodrome. Ignore the stuff that's there right now as far as rewards and things, because Josh thought he was being funny haha when he set those up.
I kind of set those up as satirical to point out how ridiculous some other people's stuff was. I'm going to be changing those to real ones. By the time you hear this, it'll most likely be changed to
real rewards.
That
makes sense. So the Lost in the Static Patreon is gone. Go to patreon.com/radiodrome. If you're a patron, you should know that the Lost in the Static stuff and the pledges that you made there have already been deleted. They've been taken care of. They're not going to be taken out of your credit card or your bank account for another month. Please re-sign up. Follow us over to patreon.com/radiodrome.
Absolutely. Now, with all that crap out of the way, you brought up tonight's topic.
We have no more time for the show. Thanks for joining us, everybody. No,
this was the housekeeping show. So, no, you brought up the topic to me, and I'll admit I kind of let you down in the research phase.
That's okay.
He sent me this list of videos I had to watch, and I watched like 3 of the 15 because I spent most of my night getting sidetracked with the other side stuff on this same site. So I'm like, yeah, I didn't watch most of the videos you gave me. I watched all the other stuff on their site. That's on me. Sorry. Well,
let's give research credit where research credit is due. A lot of this is done by a YouTube channel called Lazy Game Reviews. And if you haven't checked out that channel, please do so, because this guy has a collection of video games from PC to all the systems, and I mean all the systems, that you wouldn't believe. I mean, it makes the angry video game nerds collection pales in comparison to this guy. And he also collects old PCs, old PC add-ons, weird stuff that wasn't available in the US. He's got, I mean, he is a walking computer museum, and he does reviews of current games and older games, and he does some Let's Play stuff, and the particular series that he does that I pointed you to was LGR Oddware, and this is just the weird peripherals or weird programs or weird computer stuff that's out there. He covers it all.
Well, now when you brought this up to me initially, I was thinking of stuff like the Roland Rocker. Remember from the
that was a Nintendo add-on, but yeah.
Well, and then you had the for the track and field one. Remember that running mat one that never quite worked right.
Well, it worked fine as long as you got down on your knees and pounded on the buttons. Yes.
It didn't work the way it was still meant to. And then you had stuff like the Power Glove and whatnot. You had those kind of add-ons for the real mainstream stuff.
For the consoles, yes.
Now, the one of the problems with those was what I suspect was one of the same problems with a lot of this stuff is the idea was there, but the technology wasn't. Like the Roland Rocker. It makes sense what they were attempting to accomplish with that. That, you know, you can move the game by moving your feet and whatnot and all that. But the problem was the technology just wasn't the same with the Power Glove. In theory, you go, I see what you were going for.
Well, you just look at the Wii or the Wii U and you go, aha, that's what you were trying to
but
do.
But you couldn't do that in 1987.
Not reliably, no.
And so a lot of these things we're going to talk about, well, some of them are just stupid ideas straight from the get-go, but...
To be fair, a lot of them worked and did exactly what they were supposed to do. It's just that they were a little odd. They were not common.
They were also unnecessary in a lot of cases. It was like, really? That? You wanted to be able to spend money? Why? You know, some of them are just straight out gags. I personally found the sexy mouse to be kind of funny. For those of you who don't know, it looks like a woman's torso with her arms, legs, and head cut off. And it's your mouse, and the right and left buttons are boobies. So yeah, you get to right-click on her boobie. And I mean, I can see a certain market for that. I can't see how they thought this was going to be a big thing.
I could see it being a gag gift, but it'd be like, ha, 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 toss. You know, never use. However,
the reason Spencer's exists.
However, I think that if you run a porn store and you've got a PC up front, or, you know, like if you do rentals or something like that, or if you've got a PC up front, it's the perfect mouse to go along with it.
Yeah, but that's still a relatively limited window of use.
Or if you're Japanese.
Or if you're just a pervo.
Exactly. And I mean, not only do they have the sexy mouse, but they have the sexy mouse pads.
Which I did not see. The video, he said, because the company is long defunct, he hadn't run across one of those. I'm personally curious to see what one of those would have looked like, in all honesty.
The sexy mouse pads are still being produced. I'll show you one from Kanojo Toys and a couple other things. But yeah, you rest your wrist between the lady's boobies on the mouse pad. You know, have you ever seen those mouse pads that have the gel at the very edge or whatever? Well, it's that kind of stuff. It's just in booby form.
Okay, if you're over 12, is that still amusing?
In some places, yes, I'm sure. But we had, you know, the gag GIF things like Sexy Mouse. However, what about the Disney sound source?
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, the Disney.
I'm being honest. Ooh.
I know. The Disney sound source, back in the days of early sound processing cards, you know, for the longest time, you didn't have on motherboard sound. You'd have to go out and get a sound blaster or something like that. And there were always two big players, Sound Blaster from Creative Labs and Adlib from Adlib.
Makes sense.
And they worked in different things. They both had their pluses and minuses, and they were really cool. And it ends up that Creative Labs was the winner in that race. But Disney threw their deal in, and the Disney sound source was a thing, is a whole separate box that you plug into the back of your computer, as opposed to a card that you slot into a place. The Disney sound source, actually, it used serial pass-through in order to do all the sound processing on this separate box. And it was not common, but it was out there. And if you had, for instance, an old copy of Wolfenstein 3D or something, you'll see that Disney sound source is listed as one of the supported formats.
One of the compatibilities. But then, yes. I guess my question for that would be, since there were already other companies, and again, this is a relative niche market, isn't that kind of like DVD versus Blu-ray versus HD DVD? You all know you can't coexist here, right? You know, but it seems like at that point, Disney got in so late in the game. Did they think, our stuff is so revolutionary, or, we got to give it a shot?
No, they thought, hey, we've got the Disney name on it, and that's what's going to make it work. And it wasn't a bad, and again, this was a system that worked. It did what it said on the tin. It was just a little weird, and it was kind of a funky little setup, and it was really somewhat difficult to get working at the time. Now, granted, at the time, Creative Labs and Adlib cards were also a little difficult to get working, but usually they were much easier than the Disney sound source, and you didn't have to fart with a serial pass-through.
Well, and then one that I did watch was, I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was basically, you know how unless you had a battery backup built into a game in like the 16-bit era,
yes,
you could not save a game.
Right.
I mean, you did have codes and shit that, you know, hey, you pick up at this level with these
level password system and stuff.
But you didn't have exact saves. You didn't have save states or even checkpoints, really. Well, this was like a Super Nintendo adapter where it would save your games onto a mini hard drive within the adapter. But unfortunately, it was ridiculously complicated. Because first of all, it stuck way out of your Super Nintendo, so it's vertical. So then you'd stick the Super Nintendo game in horizontally into the middle of this giant vertical pillar. Now, just for that, you also had to have a constant supply of electricity, or 6 AA batteries.
Yeah.
And so what it would do is you would slot that in, then you would plug that into the power adapter or into the power source of the Super Nintendo, and then you would plug the Super Nintendo in from that into another cord into the wall. And it was just, this is a needlessly complicated way to use save states.
And what's amazing was they were doing the simplest thing that they could at the time.
And from the video that I saw, it did what it was supposed to, just it was ugly. It took up a ton of space. It was a power hog. He's like, my God, this thing draws power because it's, you know, constantly having to save. So this thing is an electricity and battery hog. It just seemed like it was another one of those, the ideas there. The technology just quite isn't.
Yeah, it wasn't there. Now, when you talk about weird computer peripherals, there are, and you want to talk about niche markets, there are a lot of game controllers.
Oh, my God. You go to any Goodwill, you'll see a ton of those things, man.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're so useless today.
Yeah, a ton of old joysticks and stuff like that. Well, you're a fan of pinball, right?
actual pinball. I don't like actual. The videos.
You don't like the video pinball?
I don't like
stuff?
Video pinball. I like an actual pinball machine.
Well, let's pretend that you were a fan of video pinball and you want to recreate the feel of an actual pinball machine.
Flippers?
Flippers.
Really?
That attach to the side of the keyboard, the Wizard Pinball Controller. Now, not only are they two things that you attach to the side of your keyboard and they give you a button for flippers. No. These things were actually brilliant because they did what they said they were supposed to do. They had a little motion sensor inside so you could tilt or bump just like a real pinball deal. And the buttons, so many buttons back when these were made were either on or off. You'll run across it in old driving games. You know, you hit right on the controller and your steering wheel is suddenly turned as right as it could possibly go. There's no in between. Well, that's how a lot of buttons work, but not these. A soft press will give it a little bump, and a hard press will give it a big bump.
Well, there were some, I know Sega and Super Nintendo games that were able to do that too.
Right.
Like, you know, press, you jump really high.
Yes.
A half press, you jump a little bit.
Yeah. Well, this was back in the days of DOS.
Okay.
This is pre-Nintendo or pre-Super Nintendo even. And yeah, it was funny. In fact, if you check out LGR's video on it, he actually uses the motion controls to play Doom with the Wizard Pinball Controller. It doesn't work out too well, but it, you know, but again, I mean, how you look at a product like that and you think, how many of those do you really expect to sell? Because you're talking
again, like I pointed out, relative niche market,
huge niche market, tiny niche market,
you know, like you brought up so many different controllers. I remember back in the days when I would go to a computer store, I didn't have a PC at the time, but they were the video game store as well.
By the way, the Game Saver you were talking about, it is the Nakitech, Nakitek Game Saver Plus cart for SNES.
Okay. Like I said, I just couldn't remember the name. But I remember there was all these different, like, flight games and all this stuff, and they all had, like, custom control. This one works with this controller. This one works best with this controller. This one works best with this controller.
Sure.
It's like, okay, this is getting ridiculous, you know? That why do I have to get a different controller for every game? Now, to a degree, the consoles did this, too. Have you ever seen the Street Fighter II configuration controller?
Oh, it's
like a giant board with all the different buttons with the same layout as the arcade cart and all that. And they have other specific ones. Like, remember in the arcade Forbidden Worlds, how you didn't have joysticks? You had those little knobs that you pressed down and spun around.
Yep.
There was a little adapter for games like that. But that's a real niche market.
Well, now, I can kind of understand that one because we're all familiar with emulation and MAME, and which is, for those not familiar with it, it's the Multiple Arcade Machine Emulator. I'll let you Google. Go on. Okay. But anyway, with MAME, you can get custom controllers. These are things that people usually build, and they're built out of actual arcade cabinet parts. So you've got the same feel, but it's this giant board with two players. And then it's got a trackball in the middle, and it's got the two joysticks with the six buttons, plus a start button for player one and player two, plus all of the odd controllers kind of jammed into this giant board. So if you are emulating or building a stand-up cabinet to emulate these games on, you've got a board with all the controllers you need right there for better emulation. And that stuff I can kind of stand behind because, yes, it's a niche market, but it's one that I think is big enough that you can make a profit and do quite well at.
I don't know. I see these things now and then, like at a used store or a pawn shop or something, and then I'll go and look them up, and no one's interested. I mean, these things, they tend to have a relatively short, no, not even a relatively, they have an exactly short shelf life. Because something like, you know, the Street Fighter II giant, you know, arcade board for your home, that had a shelf life of maybe 6 months. There was no way after 6 months people are still going to go, I need this.
I don't know. It might happen. But we talked about saving Nintendo games. Let's talk about storage in general.
Okay.
Because for a long time, the hard drive that we have now, which is either a regular magnetic hard drive, or now we're seeing solid state hard drives, which SSHDs are really nice. I've got two of them in my computer, and my God, are they fast. But a lot of people were coming up with new ways to make bigger and bigger storage before we found the standards that we have now. And one was the Worm magnetic optical disc drive.
Is that essentially an external?
It's an external. It's not essentially. It is an external, although you could get Worm drives built in. But it was their idea. It was a combination of optical read and magnetic save. It was really, really weird, and it was big and bulky and unreliable. And unreliable, even coming from things like the ZX Spectrum, the computer from way back when, or the Radio Shack TRS-80, you know, they stored on cassettes, just regular audio cassettes. And God, loading those things was unreliable at best. Well, the Worm drive was about the same way. It was unreliable, and eventually magnetic hard drive storage space outdid it. You know, you had we talked about the Jazz drives and the Click drives. Well, on the commercial side, you had the Worm drives and the Bernoulli boxes and all of these really weird little storage devices that people came out with that were kind of there, and they were the next best thing, and they were great and wonderful, and then regular magnetic hard drives outperformed them, and boom, they disappeared.
Well, do you think that in a case of like the Worm, that they knew they were going to have a short shelf life, that they knew something better was coming along down the highway, and that they were just, for lack of a better term, the save state for right now? For instance, like with Sega and the 32X, they knew they were making the never-released Neptune, right? But, you know, at this point, they were trying to...
Let's
try and give one more shock with the paddles to keep the Sega alive. Do you think that's disingenuous to the audience when you know you are a stopgap, you are a Band-Aid, and that's it?
No, because let's be honest. When it comes to IT and when it comes to computer peripherals and stuff, there is no ultimate long-term solution. Everything will eventually evolve. So every product you put out knowing that it has a shelf life. I think the makers of Worm drives and Bernoulli boxes and Zip drives and Click drives and all of that were all hoping that the next evolution would be a bigger and better Jazz drive, a bigger and better Zip drive, a bigger and better Worm, bigger and better Bernoulli box. And it ended up not being, just because of cost, because of bulkiness, because of speed, et cetera, et cetera. It's just, that's the way it worked out. But the thing to me that makes a peripheral odd is one that you look at and you're like, why the hell would you put those two things together?
Like?
The PC Imp mouse phone.
I don't even know what that is.
It's a mouse with a phone in it. You take off the back of the mouse, and you get a little phone pad. And it hooks up to your phone line and your computer. So if you're blah, blah, blah on your computer, somebody calls, you take off the back of the mouse, pick it up, and answer it.
You ever see this old TV show on HBO called Hardcore TV?
No.
It was a sketch comedy show. And the first episode was making fun of that, you know, the Sports Illustrated, get the football phone and whatnot like that.
Right, right, right.
It was the dildo phone. And, you know, you talk into the balls and the earpieces in the head of the dick and everything. Just made me think of that. Like, you know what? I'm honestly surprised no one made a dildo phone.
I wouldn't doubt it if somebody did. You know?
I mean, mass market. I'm sure some sicko did. I mean, I guarantee that. I mean, hell, they had the dildo phone, at least the props on the show.
Well, I'll bet somebody made one somewhere to sell.
But, I mean, honestly, I think that'd be kind of in the 90s. That would be kind of genius mass marketing. Sign up, subscribe to Playboy, get a free dildo phone.
Well, what about, I mean, phone sex?
You could jiggle the balls while you're right jiggling there. The balls.
Exactly, exactly.
But I don't know. To me, there was that time in the 90s, because you didn't say what year this was. I'm going to guess early to mid-90s.
Yeah.
Because remember, there was that time when they were trying to put a phone into everything.
Yes.
I mean, like with my dildo phone thing. Everything had a phone. I mean, Christ, I remember seeing on this old sci-fi channel program called SF Trader, they had an Enterprise phone. It was an Enterprise model, and when you picked, and then you could pick it up, and it was a telephone, and it was, they thought everything should be a telephone too as a backup. I never got that.
I don't know. But, you know, a lot of this stuff comes about too because we're not quite sure what the next thing is or what the best thing for doing a task is. You know, now you look at interfaces for computers and you think keyboard, mouse, right? Makes perfect sense.
Right.
Well, what if you don't have enough room to move a mouse around on a desk? And remember that back when you, in order to move it, you had to have more room than you do now because we didn't have things like mouse acceleration, et cetera, et cetera. You end up getting really, really weird little devices, you know, like we tried the light pen, and that kind of stuck around in the form of mobile and was kind of replaced by our thumbs on mobile phones.
I remember
and stuff.
The light pen not lasting all that long.
Right. Right.
I remember a couple of movies had that like as a key part, taking the light pen, and I'm like, wow, you're dated.
Yep. Yep. But then you end up with weird things like the Ultra Felix.
I don't know what that is
the
either.
The Ultra Felix was this kind of sort of hand shaped sort of thing where you rested the palm of your hand onto a center, it looked like a little mini mouse. It was a little tiny nub that came up out of the middle.
Okay, I thought you were thinking mini. I'm like Disney's Minnie Mouse.
No.
Why would it look like that? Why would it look like Mickey in a dress?
No, look like a little miniature mouse in the middle of this big thing, and you had a place to rest your thumb and your fingers, and you had clicky buttons on your thumb and your fingers. But then to move the mouse, do you remember the old IBM laptops that had the little eraser nub in the middle?
Oh, my God, I fucking hated those.
Oh, I did too. But you, in order to move the mouse around the screen, you would just kind of push on this eraser nub. Well, this is the big granddaddy version of the eraser nub, where you would kind of move your palm around, thereby moving the center thing. And that would move your mouse or cursor
around
the screen.
It sounds unnecessarily complicated, honestly.
It's not, really, once you start playing with it. The only problem is it didn't work half the time. And like the little eraser nubs, people went, meh, especially once touchpads came along and mice got a little bit better.
Well, let's go back to, now this is not even a 90s trend.
Okay.
But this was in the 80s and the 1950s, but obviously not for computers. 3D. Why does everyone think 3D? Nowadays, even though you and I don't like the whole real 3D nonsense, it's probably here to stay at least longer than it did in the 80s, unfortunately.
Right, yes.
Because the 90s, for movies, didn't do a whole lot with 3D.
No.
But they tried with games. Oh, remember the Sega Scope?
Well, remember...
The
Sega Scope and stuff like that. And remember... In the 90s, virtual reality was the next best thing. So if you're going to wear a helmet and have 3D, if you're going to wear a helmet and be immersed in the world, you may as well have 3D so you can have depth perception too.
But this wasn't VR. Like one of the ones that was featured on this Oddware thing was just like 3D for games like Wolfenstein and whatnot. And it's like, let's see, what was it called? It was called the... Cyber Shades,
yep.
3D glasses.
Yep.
And what it basically was, and of course it had its own power supply. So, you know what? These things always required just, I don't know how many. Remember Darren McGavin's Christmas tree in Christmas Story?
Yes.
They required one of those just to play a fucking video game
yes.
in the 90s. Jesus. But you'd plug this in and it would be like, it's not like the red and blue.
It's not the anastrophic. It's the
It's not anaglyph. It's
anaglyph.
It's it's like liquid crystals or some shit like that.
Basically, what it would do is it had a shutter system, So you're, in theory, the glasses are synced to your screen so that for a little millisecond, your left eye would be covered up and your right eye would see the screen and see what it's supposed to see. And then it would flip over and cover up your right eye with LCD. But it
in theory, goes so fast you don't notice it.
Right, and it would go fast enough that you wouldn't notice it, and it would just appear. The only problem was things would fall out, you know, they were out of sync.
You'd lose frames.
It looked ugly. To anybody else watching, it just looked like a stuttering mess.
Okay, what was the biggest complaint about the Virtual Boy?
God, I'm sure the biggest was the headaches.
That's exactly what these cause, too.
Yep.
I can't tell you how many of these computer 3D 90s glasses that I have seen reviews for or talked to people who used that said, you can't wear this for more than 15 minutes before you've got to just stop.
Well, yeah.
That they drive you nuts, that the headaches will get you. And that doesn't really go well when you're trying to play a game, does it?
No.
And then there's especially, like, in the Oddware thing, he tested on Doom, or no, Wolfenstein, sorry. And he's like, this is supposedly a special version that was made for the 3D. You know, it was, I guess, post-converted, like, you know, for the term that we use today.
Yep.
And he's like, it kind of gives a little bit of depth, but it adds absolutely nothing to the gameplay.
Right.
Because the game wasn't made in 3D. It's just like the post-conversion movies we see today, Scott. The 3D is so much of an afterthought that it's not worth the fucking headache and the, gotta remember, $1,995, the $200 for these glasses. I mean, Christ, that'd be what, almost $500 today?
Close, yeah.
To just see a tiny bit of depth in Wolfenstein, and then it was only compatible with 8 games.
Yep.
Which again goes to either the short shelf life or the we don't care, we've already got your money.
Yeah, basically. And yeah, I mean, and then you've got people like me where, hey, guess what? I only see through one eye at a time anyway, and anybody who's seen me on video knows that the other one just fucks off and goes in its own direction.
At the same time, though, again, I'm going to go to the need part. Do you need to play a game in 3D?
No, you don't. It's just neat. Do I need to
play? I don't consider it neat. I consider it irritating. But
you know, do I need to play a game on the absolute highest settings? Do I need the battle station I have now? No. But I'm happy I've got it.
Tool.
Yeah.
All right. What's next?
Well, excuse me. I mentioned emulation.
Right.
This is a little bit of Oddware that we've briefly talked about before.
Okay.
That I absolutely love. I think it was one of the most blatantly, haha, in your face, big corporation commercial hits that really hit. And it kind of proved that emulation, if it were brought out from the underground, would be a much bigger hit than people thought. And we're starting to see that with things now with the Retron 5 and the old retro game playing systems and stuff like that, which are basically emulators in pretty plastic boxes. This one came out not after the system was retired, but in its absolute heyday. And it enabled you to play PlayStation games on your PC. Stupidest name ever. The Bleem. Bleem.
Sounds like Kelly Bundy who made up that name.
Yeah, I have no idea where it came from. But
they're bleeming it to your screen? I don't know.
But nonetheless, it was called the Bleem, and it was software you would drop into your PC.
Now, is this legal? Like they licensed it from Sony?
Nope. No, in fact, that's why it had such a short shelf life and why a Bleem now is actually worth some money, even though it really doesn't work and can't work with modern systems. They're still worth a little bit of money because they came out and they were a huge hit, and then Sony came up and went, no.
And they lawyers
were,
get them.
Yeah, and they were gone. But yeah, no, this wasn't licensed or anything. And I saw TV advertising for it and everything, but the Bleem, you drop it in, and then suddenly your CD-ROM could read regular Sony games and stuff like that.
Then let me ask this question. Then how is that different from all those retro ones today?
Because when you're talking about an older system like that, and you're talking about stuff, it kind of gets into the abandonware argument of this company is no longer supporting this device. This company is no longer supporting this software. We're coming along for those that like it, and we're filling a niche. And we're filling a niche, and if they're not going to, we will. And and especially with abandonware, especially if the company is completely gone.
Well, I'm talking about something like Sega or Nintendo, where I've seen the full Sega emulator system, you know, that you can buy at the video game store.
Sure,
it's almost a plug and play, yeah. And it's got like 140 Sega games exactly as they were. And you'll notice they use the Sega logo. There's not a single Sega trademark on the box. And you go, this is a fucking bootleg, isn't it? Yeah. This is a goddamn bootleg emulator, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. But, well, I mean, the Retron 5, which is the most popular one that is being legally sold, kind of gets around it, because even though it's an emulator, what it does is you put in the cart and it reads the cart and then loads it into the ROM of the emulator. And it gets a little goofy that way. And it kind of says, well, yeah, you can play all these games, but you got to have the games. And Sega kind of went, oh, okay.
Well, let's talk about a little something I just brought up there. Plug and plays.
Okay.
Remember in the late 90s and early 2000s?
Huge.
Okay. I brought up the thing about Goodwill and controllers. Go to any Goodwill in the electronics section. Just full of plug and plays. For original games, for classic games. I mean, I've got a couple. When you see 25 cents for a plug and play for Mortal Kombat, you go, yeah, what the fuck, you know, sure.
And when you say plug and play, you're talking about the ones like it's a joystick that you plug into your TV.
Into your TV, and it gives you the exact whatever the game was. Because like
you say late 90s plug and play to me, and mine goes to the plug and play for Windows and stuff like that, and we'll talk about that too, but yeah.
Well, no, that's what these were called, were plug-and-plays, because you just plug them into your TV. They usually don't have an AC adapter. It's usually battery-powered, and it's a controller. Sometimes it's got 8 games. Like, I've got an Atari one. It's an Atari joystick,
yeah,
and it's got a bunch of games built into it.
Yep.
I've got the Mortal Kombat one, and the Mortal Kombat one is kind of funny. With go back to the early 90s, remember all the controversy about the fatalities and everything?
Yes.
It's got all the gore.
Good.
Just as default. So good. Right there, it's already better than the Super Nintendo.
That's right.
And because of the technology, you got all the sound. I mean, it is an exact port of the game.
Yeah.
And those were popular, but then they also have a relatively small shelf life, because let's face it, let's just take Mortal Kombat for example. You're a Mortal Kombat fan.
Okay.
You're probably already going to have the Sega CD version, which is at the time in the 90s, that was the only true port,
right,
of the game, was the Sega CD version, because that was, right, the only one that could get the sound proper.
Yep.
And that, to my knowledge, never went to the PlayStation. I don't think they ever got a port of the first Mortal Kombat.
I don't remember.
They got the sequels. I don't think they ever got the first one. So I think the Sega CD was the only true port. You're already going to have that, really. So who was this made for is kind of with a lot of these, like, you've got Strawberry Shortcake plug and plays and Smurfs and stuff, and you go, okay, I can see kids to a degree, but who was this made for, really?
Well, I can understand the kid's side, because it's a relatively durable piece of hardware that's relatively easy to hook up to, at the time, an old analog TV, and there it is, and you keep them distracted for a little while. The deal with the Atari one, though, for me, that is obviously, hey, here's a little nostalgia.
for $28.
Take this and play with it, and when you get bored, it'll be there. It'll be there.
Oh, I want to go back to 3D real quick. There was one thing I forgot to bring up about that.
What?
The 3D, like those glasses.
Yes.
And a lot of the 3D stuff, like the Sega Scope and that, they were made for analog televisions.
Yeah, they don't
work. The 3D will not work at all on a modern television or a computer monitor. You have to have that curved TV with that's analog, or a lot of these will not work for some reason.
And it's not even necessarily the curve. It's the it has to do with the scanning, the way that they scan, and the fact that on modern TVs, modern TVs, meaning the most up-to-date ones and LED TVs and stuff, they may actually still work.
Okay.
But things like plasmas and LCD TVs and some of the older ones that, you know, you get some fast action going there and it goes all pixely.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're getting if you do 3D on them. You get a mess of pixels. I've done that.
Well, it's even the same way with old analog movies, like the Friday the 13th box set.
Right.
Comes with Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D, and they give you a pair of the analog glasses. A
couple pairs, if I remember right, yeah.
Okay, and I know Brad Jones has had the same experience. We cannot get the 3D to work on a TV, on a modern TV or an analog TV, but it will work on a computer monitor for some reason. The 3D, at least my experience with Friday the 13th 3D on DVD, will only work on a computer monitor.
Yes.
Well, that's fucking stupid then.
Yeah, I can't argue with you there.
I don't want to watch the movie on my computer. I want to watch it on my TV, you dumb fucks. But sorry, I remembered that about 3D and I wanted to add that.
Okay, but the little, you call them plug and play dealy bobs. They're basically it's, here's a little nostalgia for $28. Fork it over. And that's what it, I know, you don't want to. And I can't really blame them there, because with dealing with the old Ataris, and I've set up so many old Atari systems.
You can't hook you can't hook one up to a modern TV because they.
You can, but it
well, okay, you got to have a bunch of different adapters, because at least the one I have, my wife's old one, has got those two little screw forks that you have to screw into the back of an old TV. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I had to get this adapter for the screw forks, which turned it into an AV, because, you know, digital, I was doing this in the 90s. And I'm like, this is ridiculous, just to hook the fucking Atari up.
And actually, you can get online, I think it's hilarious, but you can get an adapter that will plug right into the Atari that goes HDMI out.
That just seems unnecessary. It's in all honesty, that's just so unnecessary.
But it's fun, and I've done it that way, and they make it can be. But you know, in the 90s, this one, it wasn't that easy, because those adapters and those niche markets weren't out there.
But at the same time, let's go back to the screen resolution thing, Scott. You've got a thing about old games, whether it be a PC game, a console game, or whatnot. I've noticed, especially 16-bit, Super Nintendo and Sega mostly, they look like shit on a modern TV.
Well,
they're way too pixeled.
Right.
They're stretched.
Yep.
It's like these were designed for analog, and they do not work not on analog.
Yep, and that's, I can't even fight you there, because a lot of them, you know, but again, you're making for the technology of the day. Because they wanted to sell them in 1978, not in 2018.
Right.
Or whatever. So, you know, you can't really fault this old stuff for being the way it is. It's just the way it is. But, let's talk about nostalgia with computer games and why I like Steam and why I like the fact that there are some classic games available on Steam. It's because they make the games work on my system.
Define classic as era. 70s, 80s,
90s. 90s. LucasArts Adventure Games, they have one called The Dig. And I have The Dig on PC CD-ROM, which was its original format. I don't think it made it out on floppy disk, but it may have, but anyway, I've got it on PC CD-ROM, and trying to get that CD-ROM to run on a modern system, just because of the OS changes and stuff, is a bear.
When Spoonie was doing his Privateer 2, The Darkening review,
right.
he's like, you don't know how hard this was to get running for this review. He's like, you don't know how hard this was back when this was new to get fucking working and stable. It's actually harder on a modern system
yes.
to stabilize this fucking thing.
Yes.
That to me also seems short-sighted that it, you know, any game will work on this configuration only. Like, I've got a couple that I picked up for like a quarter at Goodwill or something like that, that say Windows 95 only. And I look at the year and I'm like, 2002 this was released?
Well, that makes sense.
And I'm like, so Windows 98 won't work? I mean, it's like, no, this game will only play on Windows 95. That seems unnecessarily limited.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of those games out there too. And I can tell you, if it runs on Windows 95, most of them will run on 98 and 2000 and even XP. However, when it comes to Vista and 7 and 8, it can be a little difficult.
Well, Vista and 8 suck in all regards anyway.
But the other, you know, at least with places like Steam and GOG, which is Good Old Games and stuff like that, you can get ways to get this stuff up and running. And you can even do that with some of the oddware, like some of the worm drives and the Bernoulli boxes you can get working on modern systems. Don't know why you'd want to.
I was about to say, isn't that a futile maneuver at this point?
Yeah, it depends on what data you have on worm drives or Bernoulli disks. Yeah. If you've got data,
I guess
you want
if there's shit
them,
you want off of that, yeah, I guess.
Exactly. You know.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, but then there were also things that don't make sense to me, like the Big Keys keyboard. It's a big, giant keyboard with big, giant keys on it, and it came in two configurations. QWERTY, which, okay, computer in a nursing home, need the big keys for people that don't move so well or see so well. I understand that. Or it came in a multicolored ABC configuration, where it goes ABC.
Instead of the normal keyboard layout.
Instead of the normal keyboard layout, which... Okay, for little kids trying to learn their ABCs, all right, but that's amazingly short-sighted. Why don't you release it in QWERTY and teach these little kids to type that much earlier?
And see, when I saw that, I was thinking of an editing keyboard, like what we used to have at the TV station. Remember how they had all the different,
well, at least
the different colored keys where it was like, okay, this will type this letter, or this is the hot key for a transition or whatever.
Which makes sense to me, because at least there it's a regular QWERTY keyboard with just some color-coded keys for editing, which makes complete sense to me.
Right, but that's just when I looked at it, I'm like, oh, an editing keyboard. Oh, no, it's not. Okay.
Nope, it's just in ABC, and they decided to make them all different colors and put the arrow keys way over to the side.
You know, even though something in your brain tells you, I should be able to type in ABC.
Oh, I can't.
But then if you sit down to it, and I've never tried, I'm just imagining, I'd go, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right, because even on home row, I'm not on home row anymore, you know?
Right, exactly. Now, well, the cash register at work, when I do an employee discount or ring up a meal for a manager or something like that, I have to put in their name. And I really, really wish people would stop designing those touchscreen keyboards in ABC format. It's in the big block, and it's just ABCDEF. And I'm, you know, you say to me, okay, Scott, type your name. I'm immediately S-C-O-T-T, and you just saw my left hand go.
But then you're like, S, C,
L, M, N, O. Yeah, ABCD, T.
That's the way my DVD recorder is. Oh. You know, I mean, like the standalone stuff. I'm like taking a VHS tape, and I want, you know, when I want to put the label on.
Oh, just
and
stop.
But you have to do it with the control with the controller. So arrow, 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 A, yeah. Arrow, 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 G.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my god, this is so it's one of those times where you just go, you know, with a keyboard, done. It takes me 5 minutes to label something that would take me 5 seconds to do on my computer. Right. It's like, this is frustrating.
I am hoping that we will eventually be able to look back and go, hey, remember when they used to occasionally put things in ABC format? Didn't that suck?
That was dumb.
That was dumb. Now it's all in QWERTY. Or who knows, maybe if it's the far-flung future. Now it's all in Dvorak, so we type even faster.
Damn it, I can't find the Bleem key. Yeah, it you know, I just think these things, in all honesty, a lot of this stuff, and they're still making it today, so I'm not going to lay this on the 90s, the 80s, or whatever. You go to any tech store, you're going to find probably 90% of the stuff. I'm not talking, you know, the software itself, like games and whatnot.
Actually,
probably 90% of the add-ons are completely pointless in reality, I think. Because it's like, yeah, you can use this for one or two games.
Well,
to me, that makes it pointless. Or, you know, it just, I don't see the point in it.
I own a Satek X52 flight stick and throttle system. I can't say much.
Hypocrite.
I know. but you've seen how much I play with flight simulators and stuff, and you see how seriously I take my flying. I happen to love that. It's a nice little HOTAS system with hands on throttle and stick. And I plan to save up and get Satek pedals. And who knows, I may even get a little controller to hook onto the side of my chair that will be a collective for when I do helicopters.
How about we end on what I consider, I'm sure a lot of gamers are going to burn me in effigy for this, the custom tricked out video game chairs, where they've got the special chair with the special back, and it's got the speakers in the chair and all the plug-ins, and you've got the heated seat. I've seen these things. They go for like $1,000, and I'm going, just sit in a chair and play the game!
Well,
Jesus!
And again, I look at these and I go, okay, it's your version of the rich guy that has a home theater with the big theater seats and the big, big screen and the Coke holders and the you know. All right. That's the gamer version of that.
Yeah, to me, exactly. That's the definition of unnecessary game peripheral.
Unnecessary, but cool. Unnecessary, but cool.
Okay, you know. I disagree with you, but fair enough.
Yeah. Now, what I think is going to be the future oddware, and it's out in stores right now, I believe it's Razer that makes it, or maybe it's not Razer. Maybe it's the one with the three little swirly bits for the logo. But it's a gaming mouse specifically for MMO gaming. And, I mean, you looked at my mouse and you were like, my God, that's silly, because I've got my forward and back buttons, my volume slider right here, and mute buttons, my left and right click, my center click, my wheel goes left, right, up, and down. And, you know, there's a couple other functions on this thing that are hidden. This one, that whoever is manufacturing it is making, you've got all of the buttons that I have, plus another volume slider, plus 18 more keys for your thumb, so that you can bind them to commands for your MMO, and you've got 18 commands, and their whole theory is, don't touch your keyboard again. Play it all on the mouse.
Okay. I'm going to Shatner this. Get a life!
Why? They have one.
Online?
Yeah.
It's not a real life.
Ooh, that sounds like a future topic right there.
Well, we will see. But I think this stuff's unnecessary. I do agree that they're odd, and some of these are fun curiosities to look back, and especially if you didn't grow up in this era, you'll go, wow, people bought that, or in case of some failures, people thought they would buy that.
Yeah, and you got to remember, a lot of this comes from stuff where we go, how do we do this? We don't know. Here's about four different ways. And then, you know, eventually the right one won. But yeah, it's interesting stuff. And if you have not, again, I can't give them enough credit, if you haven't checked out Lazy Game Reviews, that's who we've been talking about on the YouTube channel that gave us a lot of this oddware stuff. And check him out. He's got some amazing stuff in there. And he's got a voice kind of like mine. It's very soothing and very deep. And he'll take you thrifting with him and all sorts of other stuff. So, yeah, it's a channel worth checking out.
All right, fair enough. Just play the close.
Okay, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll see you guys next week.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.
8